Let me say at the outset how delighted and complimented I was when Stan Evans called and asked if I would participate in this regional session of the Philadelphia Society. Complimented because from the previous sessions of the Society that I've attended, I have come to associate this group with extremely eloquent, learned, insightful, and scholarly presentations of the highest caliber. When Stan discussed my topic with me, he asked me if I would give a discussion out of my background on the Caribbean and recent developments in the Caribbean. He said, we haven't heard very much about that region since the days of the Caribbean Basin Initiative. Although most of my work today focuses on developments in the area of trade policy and business developments in the broader region of Latin America, particularly some of the major economies there, I thought I'd follow instructions and talk indeed about the Caribbean and what's been going on there. Among other things, it looks like that'll be the only opportunity on a program that's very ample on Latin America to talk about this particular corner of our hemisphere. At the same time, I may win today the Wrong Way Corrigan Prize because today I'll share with you my thoughts and reflections on what's been going on in the Caribbean region in recent years. And then on Monday, I'll leave for Barbados for several days and get some firsthand updating, my first opportunity since June, that I might have been able to bring back to you if I'd succeeded in persuading Stan to reschedule this meeting of 100 people for a week later, but that didn't seem very practical. So, what's been happening in the Caribbean in the last 10 to 15 years? Remember, the Caribbean Basin Initiative took effect in January of 1984. To understand where the region is today, I think we need to think about how things were then. In Jamaica, Prime Minister Seaga's 1980 election shifted Jamaica away from the left-wing, pro-Cuban, third-world solidarity policies of the first Manley government. Seaga kicked out the Cuban troops, and U.S. and Western support replaced Cuban aid. In tiny Dominica, post-independence turmoil, left-wing governments that threatened traditional democratic freedoms with press censorship and limiting opposition media access, and the devastation of Hurricane David helped bring Prime Minister Eugenia Charles and a very different orientation of government to power in 1981. St. Lucia's 1982 general strike brought down a chaotic, left-wing, black power-oriented labor government and brought the pro-U.S. John Compton and his government back to power. Our 1983 Grenada rescue operation put an end to Cuban threats to the tiny Caribbean democracies and reinstated democratic government there in Grenada. In those days, in the 80s, we diagnosed several problems in the Caribbean region and devised initiatives working with the countries of the region to solve them. Most of the economies were based on a shaky two-legged stool, so to speak, of tourism and agriculture, or something in agriculture. Something might have been petroleum, something might have been bauxite in the cases of Trinidad and Jamaica, but it was basically two-legged stools in most of the economies. The Caribbean Basin Initiative was intended to promote diversification, greater stability, and less vulnerability to the cyclic fluctuations in the developed world economies. U.S. training programs had a role to play in that diversification. A second diagnosis: most governments had no capacity to resist a threat of overthrow or intimidation. So the U.S.-UK regional security system equipped them with some minimal reasonable capability to counter a low-level threat to their democracies. Countries with functioning democratic institutions faced a disintegration or a fraying of the infrastructure of their democracies, such as judicial institutions, systems, and processes, and a fraying of their police powers. So a variety of U.S. programs were launched to try to shore up these institutions. As a result, in the mid-80s, the Caribbean as a region had emerged from its sort of traditional condition of U.S. benign neglect. The region was clearly important to us. We were signaling that. It was reflected in the easy access of its leaders to the White House and the easy access of its governments to our resources. A remarkable assemblage of like-minded, pro-U.S., anti-communist, and at least nominally pro-free market leaders had come to power in the region. They saw most problems and priorities from a common perspective. They overcame or sublimated traditional fears or resentments of the U.S. and of Republican administrations, and saw us as key to helping them surmount their challenges. The problems to be tackled were pretty clear. They occurred largely in a Cold War context, and we developed together programs to address them. Most of the region's leaders knew, respected, and liked each other, and were able to work together and cooperate effectively. In short, there was a coherence to our policy toward the region, a reason, albeit somewhat self-interested, for our heightened interest and a commonness of purpose on the part of most of the region's governments in response. Looking back from today's vantage point, I can only say, my, how things have changed. What's changed? For one, the strategic context of our relationship has changed. Without a Cold War-type threat of communist takeovers, if you would, in the Caribbean area, our attention has simply shifted to other more pressing problems and crisis areas. As a result, a feeling of being abandoned and ignored by many in the region that developed a decade-long appetite for ready access and entree and responsiveness in Washington. For another, our priorities in our economic and trading relationships have changed. In the 80s, we were prepared to offer, and not just in the Caribbean Basin Initiative, preferential access to the U.S. market to help shore up other economies under threat. That's not the agenda of the 1990s, as we discussed today. Our agenda today is seeking reciprocal trade liberalization commitments that also open others' economies to us. This is only natural and fair and reasonable, but it's a very difficult shift for the Caribbean countries to adjust to. Some countries have caught on and have steeled themselves, or are even moving with enthusiasm to make the necessary adjustments and prepare for a world of hemispheric free trade. Trinidad, Jamaica, now Barbados is beginning in this direction. Most, however, are terrified by the prospect and are moving only slowly and reluctantly. Just to give you an idea of how much our priorities have shifted in the region and how much it has fallen in importance, we used every year at the State Department to do a report for Congress on how the CBI had benefited the region and, frankly, how it had also benefited U.S. exporters. And Congress cared enough to want the report and follow it. For your benefit, I called up to get the latest report so that I'd have the most current figures to share with you. We stopped publishing it in 1994. Third, new challenges. Fighting drugs, money laundering, and related corruption, and coping with immigration problems have replaced the old Cold War priorities. Partly as a result, our relationship with the region has now taken on what I think is a more quarrelsome character. We've had fights over bananas. Our Section 301 complaint and our complaint in the World Trade Organization against the specifics, not the principle, of preferential access for Eastern Caribbean bananas in the European Union market has been misread around the region as an attack on the foundations of tiny island economies for the benefit of one giant U.S. firm. Now, frankly, if you call up one of your friends or contacts in the Caribbean region, or if you encounter them socially, it's just as likely to be the first thing anyone in the Caribbean talks about when mentioning the relationship with the U.S., even if their country doesn't produce a single stalk of bananas. Our Helms-Burton legislation, denying visas to executives of companies that traffic in confiscated property in Cuba, and someday, if President Clinton has the courage to stop postponing applying this portion of the law, allowing the owners of those properties to sue in U.S. courts companies that may have purchased them from Castro, this legislation has been portrayed around the Caribbean as an effort to bully them into following our preferred policies on Cuba. We've had rows with Caribbean nations over our intention to deport their nationals who've committed serious crimes in the U.S. and who don't have U.S. citizenship. They don't want to take on the burden and risk of having these dangerous criminals back in their own territories. They think our society is better equipped to handle their criminals. And probably reflecting growing nationalist sensitivity in the region, in the atmosphere, in this particular atmosphere, we've quarreled with several Caribbean countries, notably Barbados, over signing so-called shipwrighter agreements, which allow the stationing of some of our enforcement personnel on each other's ships so that they can legally pursue drug runners into the territorial waters of the other country and have the needed authority to take enforcement action on the spot. What's the problem? Really, it's presentation and perception. Partly the way we presented it, partly the way it was perceived. But the perception's arisen that this is a high-handed, unilateral U.S. demand. And there's a recognition that it's practically a one-way street. I mean, can anyone really visualize one of Barbados's small patrol boats way down in the south of the Eastern Caribbean with some U.S. personnel on board chasing a drug runner into Miami Harbor to arrest them? It's great fodder for domestic politicians who want to score some local points. At the same time, not everything has changed in our relationship with the Caribbean. There are some constants, but not all of them are good. Democracy is a constant. It's alive and well and flourishing, you might say, around the Caribbean region. Since 1984, there have been elections in every democratic Caribbean state, including Haiti. Not in Cuba, of course. It's a dictatorship. Except in St. Vincent and the Bahamas, where the incumbent governments were reelected, and Haiti and Antigua, where the elected governments were really just sort of a continuation of their predecessors, opposition parties, some of which have been out of power for 10 or 15 years, have swept into office, usually with commanding majorities in the small parliaments. Some examples: Trinidad and Tobago has elected its first Indo-Trinidadian government. In the Dominican Republic, the party of Juan Bosch, remember the communist who precipitated our Dominican intervention, won the last election with a candidate and a cabinet who, of all things, is committed to privatizing national industries, reforming burdensome taxes, and opening the economy. In Barbados, which has been a traditional leader among the smaller countries, a prime minister, Owen Arthur, was elected, who is not only a highly skilled economic manager, but has the statesmanship and strategic vision to restore Barbados to its traditional leading role among the smaller economies. The downsides of all this democratic success, however, have been, first, that in many of the smaller Caribbean nations, leaders, a remarkable collection of leaders actually from the past generation, of recognized international stature and statesmanship, here I'm thinking of people like Eugenia Charles and John Compton, have been replaced by local populists of much lesser stature and much lesser capability and no international recognition. Second, the wide electoral swings that have happened from parties which have dominated their national politics for 15 to 30 years being reduced to one or two seats in the parliament and near total sweeps by traditional opposition parties make one wonder about the volatility and stability of these democracies. What's accounting for these seemingly wide electoral swings in certain countries? Third, with all the leadership changes, the traditional pattern of government in most Caribbean countries, namely strong one-man rule surrounded by a cabinet of personalities with little independence or capability, that pattern still persists, and it's probably not healthy in most of the smallest countries. Barbados is a conspicuous exception in this regard. Another constant in our relationship with the Caribbean has been the quest for economic stability and sustainability. And here I'm afraid the results aren't too encouraging as far as I can see. Despite the Caribbean Basin Initiative, the Caribbean just hasn't achieved it. Except for a few beneficiary countries, the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and such Central American countries as El Salvador, Guatemala, and Costa Rica, where diversification into textiles has created some new industry and new jobs, by and large, the CBI has failed in its diversification objectives. We're still dealing now with economies based on the same two legs of a stool, tourism and agriculture, tourism and bauxite, agriculture and petroleum. These results are kind of ironic, first because textiles are the fairly clear success story in the CBI area, are actually excluded from the Caribbean Basin Initiative coverage. Market access for those products is handled under other related quota and tariff provisions. Second, many Caribbean countries have simply failed to take advantage of Caribbean Basin Initiative benefits that were offered to them in areas of natural competitive advantage, such as the convention tax exemption for U.S. conventions that would be held in the region under the CBI. And countries that have scored the biggest economic gains from textile growth have had those gains seriously eroded by Mexico's improved access to the U.S. market via NAFTA. This is why efforts have been made for the last 4 years, so far unsuccessfully, to extend so-called NAFTA parity to the CBI beneficiary countries. Carlos Ball alluded to the latest effort in this regard in his talk. ...1997, frankly, looks like it might be the last chance for that parity legislation to pass. It's already failed once this year in August, as Carlos mentioned, but it's now arisen again, phoenix-like, in the Senate Finance Committee, and may yet have a passage in this congressional session if it doesn't compete too much with President Clinton's quest for fast-track trade negotiating authority. A final constant in our relationship with the Caribbean remains the Caribbean's quest for integration, a quest that seems as fruitless now as ever. While some Caribbean regional institutions clearly work, the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank is a case in point, the countries of the region can't seem to resist layering on new integration bureaucracies that don't work on top of old integration bureaucracies that don't work. Hence the decision a few years ago to create an association of Caribbean states to include Spanish-speaking countries like the Dominican Republic and Cuba on top of the famously ineffectual institution of CARICOM, the Caribbean Community and Common Market. Hence also the decision 4 years ago to create a common external tariff among CARICOM members, interpreted by many as an effort to raise protectionist barriers against the outside the Caribbean community trade at the very same time that countries all around the hemisphere elsewhere were in the process of lowering those barriers, an initiative whose main result, according to one of my Trinidadian friends, has been to help Trinidadian industries gobble up their less competitive counterparts elsewhere inside CARICOM. A few months ago, CARICOM voted to admit Haiti as a member, an action that reflects the region's large appetite for symbolism and gestures of regional solidarity coupled with a shortage of thinking about the practical benefits and results of doing such a thing. In May, as you all know, President Clinton went to Barbados and met with leaders from all over the region and signed a declaration for peace and prosperity in the Caribbean region. Not long ago, I heard one of his White House aides describe the meeting as the first time a U.S. president had met with leaders from all around the region on their territory. I somehow suppressed the temptation to point out that it was the first time a U.S. president had done this since Ronald Reagan did it in Barbados in 1981 and since Ronald Reagan did it in Grenada in 1986. But then President Clinton and his crew by now have become famous for their memory lapses. What happened in Barbados? At the risk of sounding cynical, substantially nothing. A declaration of sympathy and implied promises from the U.S., which Caribbean leaders already regard as largely unfulfilled and hence disappointing. The offer of a truly trivial grant of one-shot aid, much of it for very modestly named Clinton scholarships, when President Reagan launched a major scholarship program for the Caribbean that went on for a decade and trained hundreds of people in the United States, he had the modesty to call it the Presidential Scholarship Initiative. Did the visit really change anything? Frankly, I don't think so. So what should we make of all this? What is the result? In the short term, both the United States and the Caribbean nations, I think, have lost the sense of coherence, strategy, common goals, and well-defined efforts to achieve those goals that we enjoyed in the 1980s. We have... what seems to be an endless and daunting series of demands and expectations on drugs cooperation, on Cuba, etc., and unmistakably signal that the region has dropped significantly in our list of foreign policy priorities. For their part, the Caribbean nations, despite all their integration structures and formalisms, seem each to be increasingly marching to their own drummer, trying to address their national challenges and aspirations independently, as a series of county-sized countries trying to navigate successfully in a globalizing economy. For both sides of that equation, the shared goals and coherence of purpose of the 80s seem to have been replaced by a series of isolated squabbles among increasingly irritable neighbors. For the longer run, I think we have something to worry about. The CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative, and Caribbean efforts have not succeeded to replace the unstable two-legged economic stool of tourism and agriculture, as I mentioned in the past. And even small nations like Barbados that are trying to pioneer new economic directions in offshore financial services and other services and electronic commerce may find it difficult to generate the jobs required for young entrants into the labor force, even if they are successful in generating the earnings needed to propel economic growth. The diminished number of world statesmen leaders in the region, the difficult challenges of adapting to a hemisphere and a world of freer trade and global economic activity, the dangers of serious inroads of drugs trafficking and mafia-fueled money laundering and corruption in tiny islands where it's extremely difficult to root out, the wide swings in electoral outcomes which may portend a period of political restiveness, and the simplicity and ease of focusing Caribbean frustrations on the U.S., particularly with our current incoherent and quarrelsome relationship, may all spell troubled times ahead in dealing with these countries if we don't start paying more deliberate attention to this region. Thank you.